Welcome back to another exciting episode of the Captain America Minute, where we examine the 2011 Joe Johnston-directed feature, Captain America, the First Avenger, at the rate of 1 minute of screen time per episode. I'm one of your hosts just a few miles from Kitty Hawk, North Carolina. This is Jim O'Kane of TVDads.com.
And I'm Hal Bryan, an airplane nerd from the home of the Experimental Aircraft Association here in Oshkosh, Wisconsin.
And I'm Brian Fees, a graphic novelist and lifelong Avengers comic book reader.
And here we are somewhere in Italy, and Steve's having a bad day. He just didn't get along with all those tomato-throwing soldiers, and he's not sure what's going on, and just everything's bad. Well, Hal, why don't you tell us how bad things are for poor Steve and his buddies?
Well, that'll be my pleasure, Jim, to drag us through the muck.
Literally.
All right. Literally. Minute 54. In the rain-soaked Italian camp, Steve Rogers looks at Peggy Carter, his voice tinged with frustration. Serving my country. I finally got everything I wanted, and I'm wearing tights. His gaze shifts as injured soldiers limp into camp, their faces gaunt. They look like they've been through hell. Peggy's expression darkens. These men more than most. Schmidt sent out a force to Azzano. 200 men went up against him, and less than 50 returned. Your audience contained what was left of the 107th. The rest were killed or captured. Steve's eyes widens. The 107th? What? Peggy asks, catching his urgency. Come on, Steve says, already moving. They reach Colonel Phillips' command tent. Steve steps inside. Colonel Phillips. Phillips looks up. Well, if it isn't the Star-Spangled Man with a plan, says Phillips. What's your plan today? I need the casualty list from Azzano, Steve says, his voice firm. Phillips glares. You don't get to give me orders, son. I just need one name, Steve presses. Sergeant James Barnes from the 107th. Phillips points at Peggy, his tone sharp. You and I are going to have a conversation later that you won't enjoy. Steve leans forward, desperate. Please tell me if he's alive, sir. B-A-R...
Like the rifle.
Yes, just like the rifle. I was thinking that very same thing.
Wow. Well, what
a... Since you mentioned it, I fired several rounds through one of those.
How's your shoulder?
At a charity thing. So it was my beloved late stepfather-in-law and I were there with family and stuff, and he and I both decided we wanted to try it standing up. So this is a thing that from a distance looks like a normal rifle, but it's everything about it is bigger and heavier. It feels like you're hefting a telephone pole. And you know, lifted it up, leaned into it, and then it was at a charity fundraising event. So we had properly licensed dealers in there giving you access to things otherwise you would normally never get to shoot. And I remember put it on the I think it's a select fire, so a 3-round burst, and you know, lean into it as hard as I can. I'm holding it up, standing up, and it just bup bup bup. And by number 3, I was leaning over backwards at just about completely on my back. I was laughing so hard, I didn't quite fall, but one more, you could have blinked at me, and I would have gone over on my back. So the rest of it, went ahead and put the little bipod thing down and shot from sandbags, you know, laying prone. But I can't believe, you know, that there were guys who would carry that and shoot it from the shoulder like that. You were made of something much sterner.
Wow. I one of my fond memories of my bachelor party, which of all things was held at a gun range in Texas. Well, you know, being in Texas, you gotta have it at a gun range.
Welcome to Texas, right?
Yeah.
Where else?
Well, What we had was the guys in my wedding party had come over, and my late friend's son, his mom brought him over. He was 17 or so, and so we had one woman at the bachelor party, and she is a crack shot. She's just a regular Okie Annie, but we were trying the gun range had any kind of firearm that you wanted to use. They didn't have any automatics, but they had everything from BB pistols to a Desert Eagle, and
yes,
and so this fellow wanted to try out the Desert Eagle. So we're all sitting there plinking away with 9mm and stuff, and I said, yeah, get a Desert Eagle. So they loaded him up, and you have your ear protection on, and you're hearing boom, boom, boom. And then he pulls out the Desert Eagle and fires it, and it's like a cannon went off. Everybody turned simultaneously to look. And he had hit the bullseye with it, but it was just like, holy cow, what a noise.
They are massive. And yeah. So it's basically the scene in RoboCop, right? Where everybody's at the range, but all of a sudden here's this guy with something very different. Everybody stopped to look at it.
I mean, you know, it's 50 caliber. It's a half inch wide.
So unbelievable.
What was the target? A refrigerator?
No, a piece of paper.
So Brian, picture a barn. Now imagine the side of it. The broad side of it.
Oh, I'm picturing your three shots going, starting at the bottom of the barn. Yeah. The next one's about 8 feet higher. Yeah. Next one's about just over the barn.
And then back I go. So what I just realized, guys, since this minute ends, we're halfway through spelling Barnes' last name. So we get to start the next episode, NES, talking about the history of Nintendo.
I knew you were going to go there. I could feel it.
Beautiful. Hey, gentlemen, does anybody play a lovable jerk better than Tommy Lee Jones? Because in any other movie, this guy would be a villain you hated, but you can't help but love him all the way through this movie.
Right.
Even when he's thwarting really Steve at every turn.
I keep getting the feeling when you have Tommy Lee Jones in your movie, you have to write Tommy Lee Jones lines that he can throw out. I mean,
only he can say them like that, just laconically and always with a twinkle in his eye, though.
Yeah, you know, it's like what I want from each and every one of you is a hard target search at every gas station, residence, warehouse, farmhouse, hen house, outhouse, and doghouse in the area. That's one of my favorite lines. Somebody's already done The Fugitive, but I would do The Fugitive Minute in a minute. But he's
just to cover that line.
Yeah.
I'm really hard pressed to think of anybody else that you would plug into this. I mean, anybody else would be so different. I mean, I'm thinking a little bit about like, Clint Eastwood in Heartbreak Ridge, very specifically. He was, you know, just gruff and snappy and profane. And eventually there was a bit more niceness under it, but it's a different balance altogether. That's something with Tommy Lee Jones. Like even when he's barking at Peggy Carter, we're going to have this meeting you won't enjoy.
Yeah.
You know, that's scary. And
he's charming as heck though.
And the other thing you find out is that apparently he went to Captain America's show. He knows the lyrics to the Star Spangled Man with a Plan.
That's funny. Well, he seems to have some real hidden, deeply hidden affection for Steve, but not enough to give him a useful job. But I like Tommy Lee Jones in this. I think he's fantastic. Phillips is a good foil.
Yeah, I think I can't think of a bad Tommy Lee Jones movie. He always improves whatever he's in. I was thinking maybe, you know, you were asking about alternates. He was too young at the time, but Josh Brolin is kind of, I mean, he was in, you know, Men in Black.
He did the Men in Black, yeah.
Yeah,
he played Tommy Lee Jones.
Yeah, so if you can pull that off, maybe Josh. But, you know, you got to go with the original while you've got him available.
Josh is playing older roles now. I think he could do it now.
I had
one more thought. We sort of talked a little before we got started. This just occurred to me as Hal was giving his synopsis of the minute. There's a line there where Steve complains about now I'm wearing tights, and it just struck me that that's a very meta commentary on the whole idea of superhero movies. And you know, like the Christopher Reeve Superman, he wore tights. The Adam West Batman, he wore tights, and it's sort of the filmmakers nodding to the fact that, we're not gonna embarrass ourselves by putting our superheroes in tights. He's gonna wear the tights, but it's a joke. When you see Captain America as Captain America, he's gonna be wearing something a little more military. It's gonna have, you know, knee pads, and it's gonna look like it's got some armor to it, kind of like a paratrooper's outfit or something. That I thought it was an interesting meta commentary of this isn't going to be a tights movie.
No capes. Yes.
Yeah. No capes. Exactly.
No capes.
Exactly.
No capes.
Yeah. I think that all started back in the first X-Men movie where Cyclops says to Wolverine, you know, it's like, do you all wear this uniform? And he says, well, what do you want? Yellow spandex.
Yellow spandex. Yeah.
Yeah. So yeah. I think that's where it all. I think that's the origin point.
I agree. And the X-Men were all wearing these looked like leather, you know, motorcycling outfits or something.
Yeah, we had to wait for Deadpool to finally bring back the Wolverine we've come to know and love.
One could do an interesting study of the evolution of the superhero costume in film and TV, and I think they've gotten to a nice spot now where It doesn't look like tights. It doesn't look like a motorcycle jacket. It looks like something that will only exist in a superhero movie. They've usually got, it's form-fitting, but it looks thick. It looks like it takes some abuse. It's got usually a lot of fine texturing to it, a lot of detail. It's interesting what's happened to superhero costumes over the last 50 years.
Yeah.
Brian, something I hadn't thought that much about was the, you know, you, until you talked about this being this meta commentary. It's interesting to me that we, you know, we see this classic Captain America uniform, but as you say, it's a costume, it's a joke, it's there with the showgirls and stuff. We've talked about that, but what I hadn't really thought about was the fact that, you know, they're poking fun at that a little bit, but they're including it in the movie potentially for some degree of sort of comic fan service. They're making fun of it, but the entire film, start to finish, still feels respectful to the source material. I would say very respectful to the source material.
I agree. It's a kind of a very neat tightrope they walked here. I mean, I can only speak for myself, but my impression is that within comic book circles, serious fans are a little embarrassed by the whole tights thing because it is ridiculous. And Captain America's outfit in the comic books, his historic outfit from the 40s to the 2010s, it's just ridiculous. And you can't look at that and not say it's ridiculous. But
does it have an origin story? Does the uniform have an origin?
No, there's some. Oh. I think there's some retconning that Steve designed it himself. When we talk about the monkey and the bicycle minute, it shows Steve drawing that. And within the comics, Steve Rogers' job was cartoonist, which I just thought was the most self-indulgent thing ever. You know, let's make the greatest hero in the universe a comic book artist. Let's do that. Yes. You know, let's talk about ourselves artist. A little. Yeah. Exactly. But so Steve, in some continuities, designed that uniform himself, but otherwise, no, it's just something the government handed to him, and he was Captain America.
Well, I've always liked Frank Miller had a great explanation of designs for costumes, and he there's a scene in, I think it's The Dark Knight Returns, in one of the pages, Batman gets shot. And he's thinking in his head, he goes, "What do you think? I have a giant target on my chest because, stupid people will aim at the target, which is bulletproof. So shoot me there. That's fine."
I was trying to remember it's so weird that line popped into my head just like over this last weekend. I was trying to remember if that was Dark Knight Returns because he didn't have any of the yellow, or did he have any yellow in year one? I don't think he did.
It was a commentary on the yellow oval. Yeah,
but right. He's talking about. I know he was referring to the yellow, but that's great that you brought that up, Jim.
That's Miller's Batman is like one of my favorite. All of the series. I have several collections of that, and
I do too.
It's always amazing. There's my favorite panel in any comic book ever is. It's actually lifted from the 78 Superman movie where there's missiles heading and Superman has to stop the missile, and it's just this simple thing, and it's this little dot of Superman. He's just an ink blot on the face of this giant rocket, and the box that the thinking box that he has is 50 million die by fire if I am weak.
Yeah,
and it's like that's Superman in a nutshell.
Great panel in a good book.
Yeah.
Oh yeah. My favorite in the book would be Batman rearing up on the horse. There's just something
so Sables, weird. Robin. Yeah.
Yes,
yeah.
Exactly. Something so triumphant weird. About that.
Yeah. But we have another hero to talk about today.
Yeah, yeah. Let's
go. We do, yes.
Yeah.
One without quite so much angst.
Yeah, I've been looking up the 107th. I know nothing about army divisions, and I know the 2nd division was second to none, and Pershing's own on the old, the big red one and things like that, but I was wondering where the numbering came from. So my deep dive into reading army history, military stuff, is there's numbering blocks that started in 1917, and they needed a way to organize and distinguish, this massive expansion of forces when they were going to send them, over there, they're going to send all these guys overseas. The divisions weren't numbered randomly. They followed a block system. and it was based on the component of the army that they came from, with numbers assigned in order of their activation. So, you know, the smaller the number, the earlier you were activated. So the regular army, the professionals, the standing force, you know, the career guys, they were in divisions 1 through 25. Then the National Guard, which were like, you know, the state-based militias that were federalized and became part of the army for the war, they were divisions 26 through 75. And then above 75, it was called the National Army. It was the Army of the United States, or they were wartime conscripts, or, you know, they were raised together and they were later tied to the reserve. Those are divisions 76 or higher. So if you see an Army Reserve unit, like the 99th in New York, that's an Army Reserve unit that was set up during the National Army. So the 107th would be in the National Army that was established, if you remember, when, you know, his Steve's dad was in the 107th in World War I. He caught the nerve gas thing.
Oh, that's so right.
He was in the 107th, which was raised, and I'm assuming that would be, you know, and like, there's a real 99th Army Reserve. The 107th would have been in that same group, probably in Brooklyn. So, and then there's and the suborbitant units, like brigades, regiments, all that, they follow similar block numbering that's tied to their parent division's component. So you'd have like,
yeah, I was going to ask you about the Civil War and the connection with what you said. It sounds like World War One era to the Civil War, because Civil War, it was all states. It was, you know,
right, yeah,
5th,
you had
4th Massachusetts and the 24th, yeah, Michigan or what have you.
Yeah, but that was just when they were
states.
Raised. Yeah, that, yeah, was the states one. But on a national version, let's take the 101st, the Airborne Division. Okay, that's the type of work that they did. They were originally constituted as the 101st Division in 1918 during the final months of World War I, and that was out of Mississippi. So they were part of the National Army Bloc, and the war ended before the 101st, which was founded in World War I, before it ever saw combat. So it was demobilized, but then it was reconstituted as a reserve in 1921. And they were headquartered up by you, Hal. They were headquartered up in Wisconsin, in Milwaukee, as Reserve Infantry Division.
Oh, wow.
And then the 101st, wow, in August of 1942, it was activated and converted into the 101st Airborne Division at Camp Claiborne in Louisiana, during initial personnel and equipment from the 82nd Infantry Division, which was also being converted at the time to airborne. And it was one of the first two U.S. airborne divisions, along with the 82nd. So the number stayed the same due to its existing lineage, even though it was changed into a standard infantry role into parachute and airborne operations. So 82nd, even though it was doing airborne stuff, they kept their old name. And that's when, you know, they came up with the Screaming Eagles, that patch and all that. That,
right,
that was all there.
Yeah, you can so easily get lost in the minutia of it. You know, I know you're reading about the 107th, it's doing a bit of the same thing. And as you trace it through, you know, it was redesignated this, and then it was renamed that, then it was broken,
yeah,
up, and then reorganized and taken apart and put back together, you know, given this and given that. And it,
I know
if you're reading the same thing I am, Jim, do you say that it looks like it's probably still around now as the 107th support group?
The 107th is part, they continued as the New York Army National Guard after both World Wars, and then it was converted into an anti-aircraft artillery division, then back to infantry, and then it was turned into a support group in 1993, ending its infantry lineage. So but the Army never fielded a 107th division. It was always like in there somewhere. The infantry regiment was like a name, but it was mostly part of the National Guard, and it really wasn't a U.S. Army. There was nobody in the 107th Infantry Regiment in New York was deployed as that when they went somewhere. So they were taken.
I want to thank you for reminding me that Steve Rogers' dad served in the 107th, because I didn't remember that detail of the movie. So
that had slipped my mind as well.
So yeah, they both had lung problems, I remember. You know, he got nerve gas, and then his mom caught TB.
Yeah, that's a really neat connection, that continuity between Steve Rogers' dad and then his best friend, you know, some years later in the same regiment. I like that.
Right. And the fact it's New York. It's like it's a New York thing. So it's interesting that, you know, somewhere along the line, Jack Kirby knew the 107th was part of New York lore. So I'm assuming that the 107th was somewhere in the comics.
I'm not sure. Don't know. No. But you're making me look up who Jack Kirby served with.
Yeah.
Oh, there you go.
It's intriguing.
We'll be talking a lot more about this in upcoming episodes, of course, but and in advance of that, I started rereading, like, for the first time, I think, since I was a kid, pretty thoroughly rereading Sergeant Fury and Italian Commandos, comic series from episode one. And yeah, and those were the first comics I collected. We'll talk more about that later. But it's really interesting. Like, there's little nods to, you know, this is, I wish I had one in front of me, but this was, you know, written by ex-Corporal Stan Lee and illustrated by, you know, former infantryman Sergeant Jack Kirby. And there's just every issue has a little nod to their military career.
Well,
Jack Kirby served in the 11th Infantry Regiment, 5th Infantry Division. That's what I got.
Well, there you go. Okay. Well, he was in it, but he may have heard of it, or he may have known how the deployment numbers worked.
Well, he was infantry, and his job, as I recall, I don't have it in front of me, but his job, because he was such a good artist, was to basically do recon and sneak ahead, and you know, sketch out maps and diagrams, and you know, basically be a forward spy to go report back to headquarters what's up ahead.
Wow. So be good on maps and stuff.
But Kirby's war comics were just amazing because he had that history of service. You know, when he drew something, he lived it himself.
Right. Yeah, that's reflected in those books. And boy, again, I don't want to take away from future episodes, but I remember getting into those as a kid, you know, and having to go back 15, 20 years or so to start catching up. But then looking at DC's equivalent with Sergeant Rock and the difference between the two, like as a kid, Sergeant Rock grossed me out because there was always bloated purple corpses littering the battlefield and stuff. And Sergeant Fury still had a reasonable sense of realism, but it didn't, you know, they weren't trying to gross you out or shock you with every panel. So for 9, 10, 11-year-old me, that made a difference.
Oh. That's it. Well, you know, the artist most associated with Sergeant Rock was Joe Kubert, who did not serve in World War II, but he was in the Army during the Korean War. So he had a little experience to bring to it. But I wonder if that reflects just the different styles and tastes of the two, you know, creative drives behind these books. But
they may well have been doing an apples to oranges comparison if I'm looking at different eras, too. You know, if I'm just going into a comic store and say, okay, well, what do they have? Well, here's the Sergeant Rock. This looks like this, but you know, they might have been 15, 20 years apart and different sensibilities and different expectations. And it certainly wasn't gory, and it's certainly nothing that would bother me now. But it was just it's a strong impression I have as a kid. It's
like, yeah, I mean, from what I recall in reading the Howling Commandos comics at the time, I was a '60s kid, and a lot of them to me reminded me a lot of, and I don't know who was cribbing from whom, but back in the mid '60s, there was a show called Garrison's Guerrillas, which was a lot like the Dirty Dozen, and it was more about strategy and tactics than big fight scenes, and it was I learned more about blowing up bridges, I think, from the Howling Commandos than any other, like what to do and how to make it. The thing that I remember in one issue, they were talking about how to get away from blowing something up for an hour. And I didn't know you could take, what you do is you take the hour hand off of a watch. You drill a hole, an old wristwatch that had a crystal, you drill a hole in the crystal and you put the contact wire through the crystal. And you take the hour hand off, and you let the minute hand go around, and it, you know, you just set it for like 5 after, and 55 minutes later, when it hits 12, it'll blow, it'll you know, finish the circuit and blow things up. And it's like, now I know how to blow up a bridge.
Yes, yeah. And that, kids, is how you build a timer for your improvised explosive.
Yeah, yeah, Jim, I think Jim's going to make a call from the FBI later.
Yeah, hey, don't blame me. Blame the Marvel folks.
We should all bone up on Howling Commandos, because when we get to them in this movie, they're an important part, and it was a great comic book series. It's way overlooked and not respected near enough. So Let's do our research on that.
Yeah, but, good teaser. I'm having a blast going through and rereading them. Several issues in, starting at number one.
It was a great series. I would have said Combat and the old TV series Combat and Kirby really liked the little twist ending, the little Twilight Zone-y thing.
Yeah. It almost has like ghost story kind of feelings.
A little ghost story feel to it. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. The characters were haunted by things. The stuff they remember and stuff. Right. But I just remember the how to. It was just like an odd thing that you pick up in passing. It's like, oh, that's how it works. And I was like, is this? Can they really tell people how? It was very. It had an Abby Hoffman feel about it, of being very subversive. But yes. Intriguing stuff.
And it was rebranded the Anarchist Cookbook.
So yeah, there we
there
go.
There we are.
Wow. Well, this has been an intriguing episode. We didn't get into the mythical or the non-mythical town of Azano. We were having a discussion before the show started about whether they were trying to point to the invasion of the Italian mainland I think we all agree that there's no way on earth that Schmidt would have bothered having a base in Sicily. So I think he's definitely a stay on the mainland of Europe kind of guy. I don't think he'd trap himself on an island.
I think he's a Swiss Alps kind of guy.
Yeah, yeah. He needs a mountain. Well, he needs an eagle's nest.
And it's not that big of a jump from the Swiss Alps to the Italian Alps, so you know.
Yeah, yeah. So, wow. Well, we'll get into that in future.
What's an episode. Alp among friends?
Yes.
Julie Andrews could walk it in an afternoon.
And her Howling Commandos. Now there's a movie I want to see. Okay, we're work on the script there, boys. We'll get there. Well, anyway, that I think we've covered this pretty well. As we're recording this, I have to mention a piece of history that's happening while we're doing this. If as we're recording this, the Artemis Integrity spacecraft is behind the moon, so we're kind of filling in space, waiting for the acquisition of signal. And it's nice being. I know this has nothing to do with Captain America, but it's nice seeing history happening in front of you.
Sure is. And,
absolutely.
I've waited
good
for
history.
This. Yeah.
Good history.
Good
history. Kind of history.
Yes. Amen to that.
And it's something that this is. 1,000 years from now, this is the stuff that's going to really matter, that people are going to remember.
You talking about the podcast?
Yeah, well, that too. Of course. Yeah. Yes. They'll be listening to this and like, remember that time? And then there was that moon thing.
2026, but, Artemis and the Captain America minute. They go hand in hand.
Yeah, when they learn more about the 107th than any other time in history. Yeah. But yeah, it's nice. It's nice seeing some good history. And I think it's something that we need. And I'm looking forward to more of this kind of good history.
And those of us old enough to remember the first time around are feeling the same thrilling butterflies in the stomach and goosebumps on the arm hairs. And it's just it's just wonderful to see.
Yeah, we've all known Apollo era astronauts, and they were real people, and they had these pioneers that we knew. Many of them are gone as we're recording this, but it's nice knowing there's another generation of pioneers out there that have the same attitude, that they want to share this with everybody. So it's great. We're having a great day today. I think this, and it's, I think we've all needed some great days like this.
And again, pointing out quickly, Jim, as we're recording this, the wake up message for Artemis this morning was extraordinary.
Breathtaking.
Very special.
Yeah.
It was something that Jim Lovell, who you and I have both spent some time talking to or spent some time with, recorded, of course, before he died. But it was very touching. It was nice to see he was addressing the astronauts by name.
Yeah, it's personalized to them. Yeah.
And passing the torch, as of course he and Anders and Borman were doing the comparable thing with Apollo 8, and now here we are back again, finally.
Yeah, it's what a great time to be around. This is
indeed.
It's something. Wow. Well, on that note, I'd like to thank everybody for being a part of our show. If this is if you'd like to talk some more about Apollo or Artemis or any of these things, we're always available at or the 107th or anything to do with this movie by any chance. We're always available at Camp Lehigh, the Captain America Minute listeners base over on Facebook. If you do like the show, if you could, don't forget to subscribe, leave a like at the podcast streaming service where you found this episode. Also, please check out our website, capminute.com, for the latest about our podcast topics and guests. And please be sure to join us here next time on the Captain America Minute.
I can do this all day.